This is Jean McMillan interviewing Jeffrey Drury of 111 Granite Avenue, Canaan, Connecticut. The date is May 7th, 2012. He is going to speak to us about the background and history of agronautics and Lakeville lettuce. May I have your full name?
Jeffrey Drury, G-E-O-F-F-R-E-Y and D-R-U-R-Y.
Thank you. And you were born?
January 12, 1945.
And where?
Boston, Massachusetts.
Your parents' names?
Roger and Virginia Drury.
And do you have siblings?
I have three of them. One older brother named Tom lives in Pittsfield, a younger brother Daniel who lives in the Boston area, and a youngest sister, Julia, who lives in Pittsfield also.
And what is your education?
I went to Sheffield Center School in Sheffield through the sixth grade, actually through the fourth grade, and then went to fifth and sixth grade at Mount Everett Regional the first years that it opened, and then to St. Paul's School in Concord, New Hampshire for high school, and Amherst College and Yale Law School.
How did you get involved with agronautics?
I got involved with agronautics because I was a personal friend of Graham Davidson's, knew him from my high school years in Sheffield, where he had a summer place. And when it came time, when he decided that he wanted to form a corporation to undertake the venture that he visualized for agronautics, he was in New York and I was in New York working in a large law firm. And he asked me if, as a lawyer, I would form the company for him, which I did in 1976.
What was Graham's original vision?
Graham's vision for agronautics came out of the Arab oil embargo of 1974. And his hunch, maybe it was more than a hunch, that it was going to become unreasonably expensive to transport fresh produce across the country from California to the Northeast because of rising fuel prices. And he saw an opportunity to produce fresh vegetables in the Northeast to avoid that expensive and extended transportation connection, and thought that by putting the science of hydroponics together with his business background, that it should be possible to do local production for local consumption.
Who were his original partners?
His first partner was a hydroponic tomato grower named Tom Gaucher, G-A-U-C-H-E-R, who had, I believe, actually failed at growing tomatoes, but their mutual agreement was that the reason he'd failed was because tomatoes were not a good candidate for hydroponic growing in the Northeast because of the amount of heat and light that they required. And the thought was that if they grew instead butterhead lettuce, which was a more efficient converter of solar energy into plant material, that they should be able to make a commercially viable production system and business out of it. Graham then hired my younger brother Dan Drury to actually help him with the initial experimentation, construction, development of growing systems and so forth, because, as I recall, Tom dropped out of the venture very early on, I think because of personal problems that he was having. And so Graham and Dan rented a greenhouse from Hotchkiss and renovated it and began experimenting with different varieties and nutrient solutions and growing systems.
And after they finished with the Hotchkiss facility, I believe they moved to another location in Salisbury. Which would be where?
On what is now Salmon Kill Road and was then Lime Rock Road. That was made possible because in 1978, after they had been experimenting for a little over a year, I think, Graham managed to persuade J.H. Whitney and Company, which was one of the premier venture capital firms in New York City, to fund a commercial scale-up of what he was doing. And during the winter of 1978, while I actually was recuperating in the hospital in Brooklyn from an attack of ulcerative colitis, we closed financing with J.H. Whitney, and had the money necessary to actually build a larger commercial scale facility in Salisbury, where Graham was then living. He had moved from New York in about 1976 or 7. And Gus Pope, who owned the field on Lime Rock Road, was very interested in the idea of a clean, environmentally friendly local industry, and was willing to lease the property to Graham for a reasonable price. And that's where the first greenhouse was built in the fall and winter of 1978.
And what did the facility look like? Was it just a greenhouse, or did it have different sections for different processes?
That's a very good question, and it gets into the issue of what the process was that we used. Graham's early idea, deriving, I think, from what Tom Gaucher suggested and what he learned from academics, principally at Rutgers University, was that he would use a hybrid system of a growth chamber, fully controlled, indoor, artificially illuminated and heated space to grow seedlings, and would then move them out into a greenhouse for the grow-out phase when they were further apart and you couldn't pack as many of them in. So the facility in Salisbury was a combination of a what is called a Butler-type steel building. You see them all over the place for farm supply and so forth and so on. But then off the side of it was a plastic-covered greenhouse. The first one we built was a quarter of an acre. And we had inside the steel building a two large growth chambers, or one divided in half, with a very large array of large high-intensity discharge lights on a gantry overhead that could be left on 24 hours a day, and they moved back and forth on an enormous central rail in the ceiling so that they illuminated one half of the growth chamber for 12 hours and then slid through the wall and illuminated the other growth chamber for 12 hours. Plants were all started in there and then moved out into the greenhouse. And that steel building also had the offices. It had a large cooler that we stored produce in before it was shipped, had our loading dock, and had the mugs for employees for their coffee breaks.
And I read in the article that you gave me that there was a message taped to the refrigerator, make sure you eat all the donuts before you leave.
That's very true. There were donuts as well. I mentioned the mugs because there was one memorable day on which the shelf on which all the mugs, everybody had their own china mugs. And I don't remember whether somebody was climbing up and grabbed it at the wrong time or whether it simply hadn't been fastened on well enough, but the shelf came off the wall and all the mugs smashed completely on the floor. It was concrete floor, and it did quite a number on the mugs.
Oh, dear. Could you describe the process from seed to fully developed plant? In other words, what was the medium it was placed into? What was the time frame for each stage?
I may have difficulty with some of the subdivided time frames, but the process was one of seeding, and I'm going to talk about lettuce at this point, although we also grew spinach and several other crops in Salisbury. Lettuce was the one around which Graham's vision focused, and it was the one that was the dominant crop in that facility while it was open. We used so-called pelletized seed. Each lettuce seed had a little clay coating on it to make it about the size of a BB so that you could handle it. I designed and built mechanical seeders that would allow us to seed 81 seeds at a time into half of a sheet, as we call them, a sheet of foam cubes manufactured by the same company that makes the green foam that's at the bottom of all commercial flower arrangements, the Oasis Company. Each of these little cubes was about an inch square, an inch and a quarter deep, with a hole in the top. The seeds were deposited into those holes, and the sheets of cubes, 162 of them in a sheet, sat in plastic trays of the kind that are used in most commercial greenhouses, so-called 10-20 trays, because they're 10 by 20 inches. We seeded into those trays, which had slots in the bottom, and the trays were then put into larger don't know quite what we call them, troughs, trays in the growth chambers, where they were immersed in nutrient solution from below. This is a liquid nutrient that was pumped into the larger trays that the smaller trays sat in, so that the foot of each cube was wetted from below and it wicked up the moisture. The seeds would then germinate, and after they had reached a height of about an inch above the top of the cube, the cubes were all separated, cut apart, and spaced into plastic foam pallets, a material called ethafoam, which until that time was used primarily for shock-resistant packaging for valuable pieces of mechanical equipment. We used it because it was a closed-cell foam that didn't absorb any of the nutrient solution and that could be easily cleaned. We had these pallets made with holes punched in them and a grid on the bottom, so that the individual cubes with the seed, with now a little sled of seedlings in them, could be spaced into the holes in these pallets, which then floated on the surface of nutrient solution in the troughs that we had in the growth chambers. There were two spacings that were used there. One, when they were taken out of the 10-20 trays and put into the pallets for the first time, they were close together. As I mentioned, about an inch on center in the initial trays, then they were about 2 to 2.5 inches on center at the closest spacing in the pallets, and then every other plant was taken out and put into another pallet as they got larger, so that they were about 3 inches apart. And then, this is where I don't at this point remember exactly how old they were. I think it was around 14 days that they were then taken out into the greenhouse and respaced again into larger pallets, same material, same idea of holes in a white foam pallet about an inch and a half thick, 2 by 3 feet, with a grid on the bottom to keep them from falling through. At that point, they were about 6.5 inches on centers, and were put into large troughs, as we call them, which were concrete bottomed sloped troughs. They were probably about 10 feet wide and 40 or 50 feet long, with a pitch down toward the center of the greenhouse, and an arrangement that pumped nutrient solution in at the top. It flowed under the pallets, which floated on top of it, down to the bottom, drained out, and then was pumped back again to the top. This whole system is what's referred to as nutrient film technology. The plants are not put in any kind of a perlite or vermiculite or any other rooting medium. They simply sit in these cubes into which they're originally seeded, and are handled that way and ultimately harvested that way. With the roots grow down through the cube into the nutrient solution, the stem of the plant and the leaves of the plant grow up above, and as long as you provide enough space, they're able to mature into full-sized heads of lettuce. Time period from seed to harvest was approximately 36 days at the best times of year, which were not necessarily the sunniest. June seemed to be about our best time because it was a good combination of long days and reasonable temperatures. And the longest time was about 58 days from seed to harvest in the middle of winter, largely limited by light levels, but also to some degree by temperature, because it was also colder then.
Where did you get your workforce?
The workforce was local. I don't remember what the furthest was that anybody came from to work at the Salisbury facility, but the furthest I can remember, we had some from, a lot from Salisbury. We had Sheffield, Sharon, Cornwall, Canaan, Falls Village. It was something in which a lot of people were interested, and we got good press and good reports from employees, and never had any difficulty at finding good people who wanted to come and work there. It really caught a lot of people's attention and fancy.
And how did you market your product?
We started at Shagroy, as it then was. Right in the middle of...
With George Ernst?
Yes. And Graham was the principal marketer at the very beginning, taking cases of the product, which we at that point packaged in clear plastic bags with the coupon to maximize freshness and shelf life. And Graham took it first to Chagroy, and then as we produced more of this, actually I think he started selling at Chagroy with material that was with plants that were grown in the Hotchkiss greenhouse. And then obviously once we started in a quarter acre, we rapidly outgrew Chagroy's ability to sell what we had. So it was a matter of we bought a panel truck, a van, and then started taking it around to other outlets in the immediate area. And before very long, we hired a driver and marketer who did all the deliveries. And every time he saw anything that looked remotely like a grocery store, he would stop off and run in the door with a carton and make his sales pitch.
What were some of the products that were grown besides the lettuce and the spinach?
The other principal one was sprouts, which we began doing after we'd been there about 5 years. A man who'd been growing sprouts heard about us and was having difficulty finding a place for his business and came to ask if we'd be interested in picking up that as a natural concomitant of what we were doing. And so we did sprouts for a number of years. It was never a terribly successful part of the business. One of the nasty problems we had was that you were required to put a net weight on every package, and sprouts dry out over time. So we had to learn the hard way how much we had to overpack in order to be sure that by the time inspectors in New York City were weighing cups of our sprouts, a week later they'd still weigh enough so that we weren't in violation of packaging rules and regulations. There was constant experimentation with other crops, peppers, various kinds of squash, cress, and so forth. We hired fairly early in the process a PhD horticulturist named Alan Lang that we brought into the country from Nationalist China. And he was always looking for other things we might grow. I remember the first time he brought me some arugula. I don't think he knew what arugula was supposed to look like, so he grew it until it was about 2 feet tall and gave me a leaf to try. And I remember saying to him, "Alan, this tastes like green skunk." It was much too strong. We never went anywhere with any of those.
That's descriptive, certainly.
It was accurate, too.
Now, I know the business expanded to one or two other locations. Would you briefly tell us a little bit about each of the other locations?
I will. I should have perhaps said that when J.H. Whitney funded the Salisbury facility, their vision was that this would be a something that could be replicated readily all over the place. The idea was to come up with a cookie cutter and an operations manual that would enable fresh produce to be grown in inhospitable climates. And so from the very beginning, the goal was to expand as quickly as we could and have multiple production facilities. The first actual expansion we did, though, was in Salisbury. After the quarter-acre greenhouse that was built with the initial Butler building, we expanded both the building, expanded the building, and then added a third of an acre of greenhouse on the back side, first always known to us as the West Greenhouse and the second as the East Greenhouse. Then that was done in 81, I believe. In 82, 83, we built a much larger, a one-acre greenhouse in Hopewell Junction, New York. And then in 84, 85, built another one-acre greenhouse in Washingtonville, Pennsylvania, that was interesting for two reasons. One was that it was designed to use waste heat from an electric generating plant belonging to Pennsylvania Power and Light, which was interested both from a technological point of view and a public relations point of view in trying to develop uses for the waste heat, enormous amounts of waste heat that they threw up into the sky from the cooling towers that they had for condensing water from their generators, electrical generators. And also because that was the place where we started scaling up for the first time. The 1 acre that we built was intended to be the first quarter of a 4-acre facility. We never actually did build the other 3 acres, but That one was interesting because it had the best technology we developed in terms of growing systems, and it also was the lowest cost of production because of the use of the waste heat and a special electric rate that we were able to negotiate with PPL's help with the Pennsylvania Department of Public Utility, so that we were able to use more supplemental lighting there in the greenhouse as well as in the growth chamber areas.
And how many years did Lakeville Lettuce in Salisbury actually exist?
Good question. We started building, well, if you go back to Hotchkiss, you're talking about 1977 through the bankruptcy that was filed in February of 1989. The first commercial facility was, as I said before, built in the fall and winter of 1978. I remember that it was winter because we had to thaw the sandwiches that we were bringing for lunch on top of the kerosene salamanders that we used to keep ourselves from freezing to death.
That would be a winter experience.
That was a winter experience.
And what was the cause of the bankruptcy?
Cause of the bankruptcy, probably there is more than one cause, multifactorial situation. Two problems, basically. One was that it turned out that although Graham's idea had been that the academics of the horticultural world had worked out the technology for what was needed to create a viable commercial hydroponic venture, and that what he needed to do was to marry his business expertise with existing and readily available technological expertise to create a business. That was not the case. Once we actually began trying to solve all the problems that commercial scale hydroponic production involved, we discovered that the academics, although they had learned a lot about some pieces of the puzzle, had never put the puzzle together. And it took us much longer than anybody had expected to solve enough of those practical scaling up problems so that we had to borrow a lot of money and equity investors had to put in a lot of money. Borrowed money. The second problem was that, maybe I'll end up with three problems. Second problem was that lettuce, which was the crop that Graham had fastened on because it could be grown at relatively low temperatures with relatively low light levels, and was relatively easy to grow, was also relatively easy for everybody else to grow. And we attracted, through consistently interested press, a host of imitators who were attracted by the idea, really had no idea of what their costs really were, but when they had a greenhouse full of lettuce all of a sudden ready to sell, discovered that if they simply undercut our price, they found a lot of interest on the part of the stores. So we faced a constantly rotating series of competitors, much smaller than ourselves, much less sophisticated than ourselves perhaps, but who ran themselves into the ground and themselves into bankruptcy and pulled us along with them by keeping the price down. And the third problem perhaps was the fact that it was lettuce. I think we ultimately concluded that lettuce was too much of a commodity. The Arabs did not keep the faucets turned off on the oil. Lettuce kept coming in from California through inexpensive trucking. You couldn't, even with high quality and high freshness and freedom from pesticides and the other things that were a part of our marketing attraction, even with that, you couldn't actually maintain a real premium price for the product. And there simply wasn't enough of a margin with the competition from California and the competition from other local hydroponic growers to support the kind of debt that we had taken on in order to build these facilities and learn the things that we needed to learn. And the combination of those, when we finally got to late 88, early 89, J.H. Whitney, which had continued to pour money into the operation as we went along, decided that they were not convinced that, in fact, we were going to be able to develop the model that they had hoped for that could be replicated endlessly, perhaps in the Middle East, perhaps in the Northeast as well, and announced that they were not going to put any more money in. And we had some particular production problems during about a six-week run in the early 89. And it became obvious that we were simply not going to be able to meet payroll and meet other obligations. And so fortunately, we did recognize that early enough and filed for bankruptcy for Chapter 7 before things were really in a dreadful state. We were able to pay all the employees what they were owed. We were able to pay all the suppliers what they were owed. In effect, it was only the equity investors who ended up taking a major bath.
Is there any other information that I haven't asked you about that you'd like to add to this interview?
Well, I think, yes, I would like to add one other thing, and that is that while the original vision of hydroponic production of lettuce in particular in the Northeast, made possible by the cost of shipping from California, did not in fact prove what Graham had hoped it would prove and was not ultimately economically successful. He did lay the foundation through the work that was done during those 11 years or so for, first of all, other hydroponic operations that have been successful subsequently, but also for, in fact, a successor to Agronautics itself. One of the principal equity investors in Agronautics, who had come on relatively late in the process, decided that he thought there was enough promise in it, so he bought the Pennsylvania facility out of the bankruptcy and transformed it into a non-lettuce producing operation, doing instead a much lower volume, higher grade, if you will, salad green called mash, or lamb's lettuce, which had previously been imported only from Europe, and has been very successful with that. So I think in many ways, although the details of Graham's vision may not have worked out the way he'd hoped, the vision itself has been carried on and I think has ultimately been very successful.
Thank you very much for the interview. It's been very informative and I've learned a great deal.
You're very welcome.